Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome back our speaker for today, Professor Simon Platt, based at College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Georgia. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Great. All right, let's get started. So today's session is on neurological diseases affecting young dogs. There'll be some cats in here as well, but we're just focusing on some diseases which we may sometimes call congenital, acquired, inherited. So we'll clarify what those are, and we're just going to spend a little bit of time talking about how we would suspect them, how we would work them up to confirm them, and how we would treat them. So when we look at the differential diagnoses that we often consider for neurological diseases, they include this list that fall under the mnemonic of vitamin D. V for vascular often affects older animals. Inflammatory is young adults to older animals. Obviously, can affect any age. It's certainly something that we do see occasionally in younger animals, particularly discospondylitis. Trauma can affect any age, as can toxin, but is non-specific. So these things we've talked about here are not just younger animals. Anomalous disease, which we'll focus on today, is some sort of structural abnormality, and that can be a congenital issue or it can be an inherited problem. And we'll talk about what those are. Metabolic disease, so particularly hepatic encephalopathy, often affects young animals, causing clinical signs that most of the time are forebrain in nature. Idiopathic diseases, neoplastic nutritional diseases, we're going to leave those alone today. Most of the time, they will affect older animals, and the nutritional problems can affect young animals as well, but not specifically so. It depends on the diets that are being fed and when they're being fed. And then degenerative diseases, we'll touch on these today. These encompass lysosomal storage diseases, for instance. These are diseases that are due to an enzyme missing in the brain, which means that there's a failure to metabolize some of the nutrients that are delivered to the brain. And then cerebellar hypoplasia, a classic degenerative disease of the cerebellum in cats, usually due to an infectious disease while in utero. So it's just an overview of what we're going to deal with today: anomalous metabolic, so structural changes and anomalous changes, and metabolic diseases and degenerative. Overall, as we've said, congenital lesions, so diseases affecting the young that in some way they're born with, can be inherited or acquired. Now, often they're breed related, and often there are multiple affected. So it's worthwhile actually looking at a history of the litter. That might not be possible. Owners may not know. Some people might want to disclose this information, but where you've got at least more than one affected, you start to think about the possibility of this being a congenital inherited lesion. Any of these lesions they're born with can affect the brain, spinal cord, the skull, and or the vertebra. They may be static or progressive, so they may be born with these diseases, or the diseases themselves can progress with time. That might help you, and some of them may be even fairly late onset, even though the majority will occur in the first few months of life. The diseases themselves may be incidental, so you might just find them on a radiograph, for instance, a structural anomaly of the vertebra, for instance, one of which AA subluxation we'll talk about, which is not usually incidental, but some of the other vertebral anomalies can be incidental. Some, though, can be severely debilitating and fatal. And so we have to sometimes look at these with an eye of what initially could be a responsible for the clinical signs. Let's talk about the first of these issues that we're going to deal with, a congenital anomaly that affects the brain, and this is hydrocephalus. So hydrocephalus, seen in people and in animals, dogs particularly, is an enlargement of the ventricular system. We need to go back to have a look at the creation of CSF fluid just before we talk about hydrocephalus, to talk about how this could arise. So here we see in the creation of the CSF from the lateral ventricles. That CSF is then pushed backwards through the third ventricle, underneath the cerebellum in the fourth ventricle, round the nervous system in the subarachnoid space, and often is then taken out of the nervous system via the subarachnoid granulations, but then goes down the spinal cord as well. So this is a constant production via ultrafiltration of the blood, and something which tends to replace the CSF volume 5 times during the day. So it is a high volume production system. This system can cause a problem if it is blocked in any way, partially, causing a backup, which results in ventricular megaly and/or hydrocephalus. So the blockage that we can see can be congenital versus acquired. Congenital lesions, which are most common, an animal is born with some type of obstruction to, for instance, the mesencephalic aqueduct, which is the canal essentially going from the third to the fourth ventricle, and that can lead to a backup and dilation of the lateral ventricles and maybe the third ventricle. However, there are some acquired causes of obstruction, acquired causes of hydrocephalus that are obstruction, so from a tumor, poor absorption, so the arachnoid granulations may be affected by disease and or increased production, which is rare, but it's also a possibility. So there are some acquired possibilities. Late age hydrocephalus is something that we do frequently see related to neoplasia or inflammation, causing some type of obstruction to the flow and drainage of CSF. So here we can see the obstruction, for instance, at the region of the mesencephalic aqueduct, or to the apertures of the lateral ventricles, will cause increased size due to just backup of the fluid. So what do we see? Well, this is a disease which often affects toy breed dogs, brachycephalic dogs, presents at quite a young age, 6 to 12 months, and has a variable progression. Some dogs can be clinically silent for a while, but usually they will all show clinical signs once the degree of dilation of the ventricles is significant enough. What we see is that these dogs are often a small physical size, in addition to having this abnormality, and they show a propensity for decreased learning. They have an enlarged dome-shaped head, and the reason for this is that the ventricles are enlarging, and the skull plates have not sealed yet, and so they tend to then get pushed out and float on top of the brain, resulting in this kind of domed head. We then will see increased open fontanelles, as we see here, an open area in the skull in which you can actually palpate through the skin. This does not imply 100% that the animal has hydrocephalus. Some breeds, for instance, the Chihuahua, may have an open fontanelle for life, just as a breed standard. So you have to be careful interpreting the presence of an open fontanelle. It doesn't always mean that you'll have hydrocephalus, but most patients with hydrocephalus will have an open fontanelle. In addition to the domed skull resulting from the skull plates being pushed outwards, then we may also have ventrolateral strabismus. And ventrolateral strabismus results from the orbital bone structure being displaced, pushing physically the eyes outwards, as we'll see in a video in a second. So here's a toy breed dog that presented with a domed skull and concurrent neurologic signs, as you'll see a gait abnormality, circling. There were mental changes as well, visual changes, and the dog then began to seizure. So these are things that are non-specific brain signs due to the expansion of the ventricles causing pressure and damage to the brain by taking up brain tissue. So we have a very notable circling pattern here, a poor gait, and the dog was also poorly visual. So this is a fairly severe presentation. Some dogs will just present with seizures, some dogs with visual abnormalities, but often the disease itself is progressive. As we just said, we can see ventrolateral strabismus. This is a very short video of a chow that had hydrocephalus, couldn't really see the domed skull. But you can see the eyes that are pointing down and out. So that's strabismus. So ventrolateral strabismus, and they're pointing down and out because the orbital bones that encase the caudal aspect of the eye socket are pushed outwards. So some physical abnormalities that may help you with the diagnosis, in addition to some of the neurologic clinical signs, which are non-specific but do tell you that you have forebrain disease. Radiographs can help as well, but they're really not as helpful as advanced imaging, as we'll see. Radiographs may document an open fontanelle. They sometimes may give you what's called a ground glass appearance to the intracranial cavity because the inner rugae of the calvaria are flattened, and so you don't tend to get as much in the way of an irregular pattern within the skull. So something to consider there, but it's not non-specific, and if you saw a normal skull, doesn't rule out hydrocephalus, obviously not having much information on the brain. Ultrasound is a rather non-invasive way for us to get a bit closer to what's going on. You do need an open fontanelle, which, as we said, is present in some of these dogs. The open fontanelle gives us a window of access for a small pediatric probe using ultrasound jelly. We can potentially see the size of those ventricles. As we see in this video here, again, a short video that we're going to look at, you can see that we have large hypoechoic chambers here. This is fluid. This inverted Y that we see here is the midlines, the falx, and this is coming over the brainstem. These black areas, so here and here are lateral ventricles, here lateral ventricles, and then here third ventricle. So a lot of fluid buildup here, and roughly the rule of thumb that we discuss in terms of documenting whether fluid and fluid cavity enlargement in the brain equates to hydrocephalus is the fact that the fluid in adds up to more than 60% of the brain volume. So this would be a case that we would believe would be hydrocephalus based on that, so over 60%. So a rather non-invasive mechanism for us to document this disease. However, advanced imaging is going to be a more specific way for us to document structural change in the brain. Here, CT or MRI can help. Obviously, MRI more specific for this. And we can see here that we have a rather thin rim of brain that is left here in this dog. And here we have his midbrain, mesencephalic aqueduct. So lateral ventricles are extremely large and take up way more than 90% of the intracranial cavity. Unfortunately, this is a dog that had to be euthanized based on its quality of life and the lack of treatment options. And so you can see the extent of the hydrocephalus. This is an important point here to mention, in that the clinical signs that we see in some of these cases may actually be permanent because of the structural damage that has taken place. And so any treatment aims that you have should be tempered with the fact that some damage may be permanent. It's difficult to imagine that this would be brain tissue that would in any way improve in terms of its function once you have removed either pressure and or volume of fluid. In fact, it is difficult to believe that if you did remove a lot of the fluid here, that these walls of the cerebrum would not cave in, which is an issue when we're talking about the surgical repair of this disease, which we'll say in a second about. So how do we treat congenital hydrocephalus or hydrocephalus of any real origin, so ventricular enlargement? We do have medical and surgical options. The medical option is to try to reduce the CSF production, so reduce it at source. We can do that with anti-inflammatory medications such as prednisone. You can do it with diuretics such as furosemide, acetazolamide, and we can do it with a proton pump inhibitor, omeprazole. The mechanism of action of that drug specifically is unknown, but certainly something which seems to reduce CSF volume. Clinically, we're not sure how it equates to improvement, but you can certainly combine all of these medications. Anticonvulsants are often used if the patient is presenting with seizure activity, and if their medical treatment is failing, and it is believed that the drainage of these ventricles may offer some hope to the individual patient, then potentially we could look at surgical shunting. So we put a fenestrated tube into the ventricle, and which comes out of the skull. And as you can see in this inset here, that's attached to a small valve, and it's a one-way valve. Fluid coming out when it reaches a certain pressure, and then flows down this subcutaneous tube into the abdomen, and that then will just drain away. So certainly, we have a surgical option for these patients. It's expensive because the appropriate tubing is often necessarily purchased from human drug companies and medical device companies, and so it can be extremely prohibitive for some people based on finances, in addition to the cost of the surgery and to the lack of a guarantee that this surgery can provide. Similar to the development of hydrocephalus from ventricular enlargement, we have the development of fluid enlargement in the spinal cord or syringomyelia, which is often related in certain breeds of dogs, such as Cavalier, to Chiari-like malformation. Now, we're not going to cover this in this session because we've already just recently focused on updating this in a previous neurology session. So just to mention that a frequent young dog disease affecting the ventricular system and causing a variety of clinical signs is Chiari-like malformation, which is often associated with syringomyelia. Allantoaxial subluxation. So we're going to focus now on another anomaly, but this time of the vertebral column, and this can lead to some fairly devastating clinical signs affecting the nervous system, particularly cervical spinal cord. So what do we see? Well, often this affects young breeds of dogs, toy breeds again, much like the hydrocephalus actually, but occasionally can be seen in adults. The majority of them will present with some type of gait dysfunction. Often they're walking, can be asymmetric, can just be ataxia, mild paresis. Two-thirds of them will present with some sort of neck pain, and that may be on its own without a gait abnormality, but it's not common. Often they'll have mild deficits in postural reactions, proprioception. 10% of them will be severely affected and have tetraplegia, so not common, but an acute onset of severe signs is a possibility. Now, we may also see some odd signs. We've seen vestibular disease, we've seen seizures associated with this, we've seen torticollis. There are various explanations for this, but most of the time we're actually looking at patients that have cervical spinal cord signs. So what are the factors that cause it? Well, as we said, this is a vertebral anomaly, and there are various abnormalities that can contribute to the presence of a subluxation. 24% of cases in one study actually had a normal DENS, and that's important because the majority of the time the suspicion is that the patient itself has a subluxation of these two vertebrae because the DENS is either abnormal or even missing. So nearly half of patients have a hypoplastic or aplastic DENS. There is angulation or fracture of the DENS in some cases. And some cases there's an absence of a transverse ligament. And this transverse ligament is the ligament that binds down here the DENS to, as you can see here, the DENS to the first cervical vertebra. So an absence, congenital absence of that can lead to subluxation. Recently, some work has suggested that there can be an associated incomplete ossification of the atlas, and potentially even associated block vertebra, where particularly C2 and C3 are fused. And these can lead to abnormal biomechanics of the vertebral column, which can predispose the patient to a subluxation. So we see that we may have a normal structure of the atlantoaxial vertebral column here, vertebra. If you have an aplastic dens or missing dens, that may put a lot of strain on this joint here. But the fact that there is no dens means that the spinal cord potentially won't get injured. We see here a deviated dens. If it's dorsally deviated, just a minor subluxation can cause ventral concussion, compression of the spinal cord. And then a fractured dens can also be present, and often secondary to trauma can cause a significant spinal cord disease. So radiographs are helpful to document a subluxation. You can also document the congenital anomalies such as an abnormal hypoplastic aplastic den, as you see here. You can see the subluxation present between C1 and C2 here. It isn't necessary to put such a extreme amount of flexion on the neck as we see here. This is very dangerous because in the presence of a subluxation, we may see severe spinal cord compression. So maybe necessary to slightly flex the neck vertebral column to exacerbate the subluxation and prove that that's what you have, but not to the extreme that you see here, which actually would be dangerous. So sometimes what we do is do some fluoroscopy where we mildly flex the neck, which you might be able to see here. This is a normal dog where we could actually flex the neck and see that there was very little movement between C1 and C2. So if you have access to fluoroscopy, that can help. Otherwise, just doing 2 to 3 mildly flexed extended views, neutral to flex views, may help you with this scenario. CT is much more specific for bone structure, obviously, and the relationship between one bone and another. And so this is something which we can use to not only confirm the presence of an AA subluxation, as we see here. So here is C2 riding above C1, but we can also measure the bone for future implantation of screws, and that's something which can be essential if we're going to ultimately repair this surgically. MRI helps again with measurement of bone. As you can see, it's a little less sensitive to bone size than CT, but it is something that can be used. We can see a huge joint space here, so confirmation of the subluxation. But MRI will help us not only with confirming the severity of the compression associated with AA subluxation, as you see here, but also any concurrent anomalous diseases, such as ventricular megaly, for instance, such as Chiari subluxation, Schwinger myelia. And this may help us in determining the ultimate prognosis. So how do we treat this? Well, medically, the options that you have are a combination of pain relief with strict rest, and that strict rest needs to be accompanied by some support to the vertebral column, what's called external coaptation, where we're actually putting in a splint ventrally, so underneath the neck, going from the mandible to the sternum here, and then wrapping the body like this. It's actually quite an aggressive way to deal with the subluxation, but it is necessary. You're only encouraging fibrous fusion between the first two vertebrae. It's not osseous fusion, so it's temporary, and recurrence is likely. In fact, overall, one study suggests that the success rate is no more than 4 out of 10, with long-term recurrence being the problem. Usually, it's been shown to be more successful if you catch these dogs early and can wrap them early. These are often small dogs, and they don't like being wrapped up like this, and this can cause a variety of problems, which can include skin diseases because of the fact that they're in these wraps and they have a splint for a long period of time, 6 to 8 weeks. Ideal then for them to be changed on a weekly basis under anesthesia, so that can actually be expensive. Can cause some respiratory issues with restriction of expansion of the thorax. Can cause some overheating as well, and they're often quite depressed because of it. But strict rest is essential, and this is really the only way to enforce it because it does keep the vertebra aligned if possible, but unfortunately, as we said, it only encourages fibrous union rather than osseous union, which long term is not good enough. So when we talk about surgical treatment for AA subluxation, then we have a variety of techniques that are available to us. There are some dorsal techniques, as we can see here, where often involves some sort of wiring or suture material passed between C1 and C2 to fix them biomechanically. It's a preferable way to go, but sometimes can be very difficult to actually check that you've got the two vertebrae realigned. And in young dogs, which is what this disease usually affects, it may put a tremendous amount of stress on the arch of C1, and you can actually cause trauma to C1, even rip that arch away. Potentially, external coaptation is still necessary in some of these dogs that undergo surgery, but with a ventral approach, particularly the surgical repair can be quite solid, and it doesn't necessitate a further neck wrap, which can be prohibitive for any sort of movement and quality of life for several weeks. Overall, the success rate is quite high. It's quoted as being anywhere from about 50% to 90%. Probably from what we see, it's 80 to 90%. Seemingly better in young patients than those with shorter period duration of signs. Most of the time, this is a surgery, particularly if it's a ventral approach, that encourages osseous fusion, unlike the medical approach. And therefore, the fusion itself, which can take place quite quickly in these young dogs, the fusion itself can be long term and so can be successful. The complications, though, are many. They include misalignment, so you fix the vertebrae in an incorrect position, so there may still be quite a significant compression. Implant failure or migration, and you'd hope that if the implants do fail or migrate, that occurs after the time of osseous fusion, but you might need to go back in and do something about that because a migrating pin, for instance, is often a big concern. Soft tissue, neuro tissue damage, certainly in a small area because of the size of these patients, it is possible to damage local neuro tissue and soft tissues, particularly compromising the upper respiratory and upper GI tract with these type of surgeries. And potentially these animals may have respiratory arrests secondary to surgery. In one study, death was reported as being a possibility in 10% of cases. I think that's a little high, but it is something worth discussing with the owner that we may have 8 out of 10 of these dogs go on to have long-term success following the surgical repair and fusion. However, it isn't something, unfortunately, that is a guarantee, and it may actually result in a need for euthanasia or even death due to respiratory compromise. This is one mechanism, a couple of mechanisms of ventral surgical fusion. So here we have the dog on its back, and you see C1, C2, and we put screws in C2 first, and you can see here tensions created by wrapping cerclage wire or suture material around the heads of those screws, and that pulls the vertebra up together because you need to realign these vertebrae before you end up putting implants in the vertebra between C1 and C2. So transarticular fixation for instance, as we see here, is going to necessitate realignment. And realignment can be difficult. You can do this with bone holding forceps. Sometimes these bones are very soft because of the age of the patient. And so that is something which unfortunately means that we need to look at other options rather than the somewhat traumatic bone holding forceps. So we will do that with putting screws in and cerclage wire or suture around the heads and lifting them together. We often look at getting multiple implants in, and so 2 to 3 in C1, as well as the transarticular fixation, as we can see. So here, threaded pins, you can use lag screws, and then 2 screws in C2. This multiple implant approach that we've published is something which does tend to result in osseous fusion, and on a long-term basis has minimal complications associated with it. So those are structural anomalies. Now we come on to some more chemical-based abnormalities, and the first of these is a metabolic problem, and that is hepatic encephalopathy. And hepatic encephalopathy is an abnormality of liver function that can be due to a congenital structural abnormality such as a portal systemic shunt. It can be seen in older patients as well, obviously, due to liver disease, dysfunction, cirrhosis. The clinical signs that we see are often waxing and waning as the toxins that aren't filtered from the liver end up affecting the brain. Progression, though, that we see is often fairly chronic and insidious. We're often going to see symmetrical signs, and this is because the toxins that come from the liver aren't just going to focus on the left side or the right side, but you can see circling, which can be a bit confusing. But any other signs are usually fairly symmetrical, so blindness. Pacing, seizure activity can also be seen, and they may be the only signs that you see at all. But they're non-specific signs of forebrain dysfunction due to the poisonous nature of the toxins which aren't filtered from the liver. Often common to see systemic signs, and so we may have GI issues, appetite issues, weight gain, loss issues as well to consider, which may help us focus in on systemic signs on metabolic disease. So again, non-specific. So this is a video of a Yorkshire Terrier that presented to us that had a hepatic encephalopathy. And this dog would just pace around the house non-stop, had visual disturbance, so would bump into things, would bump into the wall. When it went under furniture, as you'll see, it got trapped under the furniture. Obviously had evidence of cerebral disease. It's non-specific in that it doesn't tell us for sure this is hydrocephalus, so that it is hepatic encephalopathy. So we need to look at the diagnostic tests that are required to determine that this is present and rule out other diseases as well. Okay, so what happens in these cases? Well, depending on the type of disease that's affecting the liver, ultimately there's a decreased toxin filtering, and that leads to hepatic encephalopathy, which is essentially brain dysfunction, because the toxins are going to directly or indirectly affect that brain function. Most of the time that we focus on the toxins being ammonia based, because this is a very powerful sedative and is a direct neurotoxin. There are multiple toxins that are involved in this, but ammonia is the main one that we often look at as being responsible. So we end up seeing these forebrain signs due to an excess of ammonia in the brain. Diagnosing this can be fairly simple in that it can rely on blood work and some basic chemical tests. Blood work, many dogs will have microcytosis. Cats can often have a low BUN and then be a low protein albumin concentration in dogs due to obviously poor liver function. ALT and alk-phos can be quite low as well. In the urine, occasionally you will see urate crystal development. Resting ammonia concentration can be quite high, and pre and postprandial bile acids are often confirmatory of the presence of liver function abnormality. Imaging radiographs will see a small liver, but ultrasound is quite sensitive for the presence of a portosystemic shunt, so should be considered. No real need, though, for advanced imaging or a CSF taps in these patients. The main goal of treatment is try to reduce ammonia, as that is the main toxin that results in the in this problem. We try to restrict protein. This is a high this is performed by using a high quality, highly bioavailable diet. There are a lot of specific commercial diets available for liver dysfunction, and those can be advantageous in these. They tend to reduce the protein load, which results in less of an amino acid load, which results in less creation of ammonia. So really, protein restriction is the mainstay of treatment in these patients, in addition to trying to decrease the quantity of bacteria that can be responsible for the creation of ammonia. And so decreasing these bacteria using antibiotics, using particularly metronidazole or ampicillin, but neomycin itself can be used. So it can be a successful adjunct to a change in diet. Lactulose is the third type of treatment that we'll use in conjunction to diet and antibiotics. This is a synthetic carbohydrate that's often used as a stool softener, but what it does is decreases transit time so that the food substances are not in the intestine for a long period of time, so that less ammonia can actually translocate into the body. But it also decreases colonic pH, which traps ammonia as ammonium in the lumen, and therefore reduces the amount of ammonia transferring again to the body. So it can be quite successful. Even in an emergency basis, you could use lactulose as an enema and can reduce the load of ammonia crossing the colon into the body. In addition to those three things, so the protein-focused diet, the antibiotics, and the lactulose, we often will look at the need for anticonvulsants because these dogs may seizure before or even after surgery for a portosystemic shunt if that was necessary to treat these guys more specifically. The anticonvulsants will often use our potassium bromide and/or levetiracetam because they do not go through or metabolized by the liver. And tend to try to avoid barbiturates, benzodiazepines, any other drugs that are metabolized by the liver, just because that puts an excess of stress and these dogs can become very sedate in the face of those drugs. So then we end up with the degenerative diseases, which is where we'll finish, as they're not common but worthwhile noting them, particularly if you have a young animal presenting and there are multiple affected in the litter. These are lysosomal storage diseases in the main, and these are diseases that essentially are catabolic failures where an enzyme is missing, and so you don't get a breakdown of nutrition. The storage material there, or the material that isn't broken down, then gets accumulated and leads to an array of fairly non-specific clinical signs. Often affects the cerebellum. And so a young animal with cerebellar signs, there should be some concern for the fact that this may be a degenerative disease, and it is often progressive as well. Takes out pure breed animals most commonly, but mixed breed can be affected in cats. And it is a difficult set of diseases to diagnose as ante-mortem, as we'll talk about. So there are various types of these storage diseases, and they're often named based on the deficiency of the enzyme that is present, the accumulation of the metabolite that can't be broken down because this missing enzyme then will determine the clinical signs most of the time. So we see then an array of storage diseases. Most of them will affect the central nervous system, as we'll talk about. Some affect the peripheral nervous system, and some will affect other structures around the body as well. And so worthwhile being aware that you could have a multi-system disease. We often are going to see this affect males and females. And although there are many recognized breed predilections, so you'll need to go on the internet or look in a book to see whether the breed you have in front of you has been documented with this, it sometimes can be affecting a new breed. So worthwhile knowing that. And most of them will affect immature animals. There are some that are late onset or adult onset diseases, but most will affect fairly young, so from 3 months onwards. And as we said, it is a progressive disease, slowly progressive, affecting nervous system, particularly starting in the cerebellum in many cases. Clinical signs, when we talk about the CNS and neuromuscular signs that we are involved often, and we talk about cerebellar disease, this leads to tremors, ataxia, dysmetria, and nystagmus. Can then progress to forebrain signs, which are seizures and mentation changes. Some patients will have peripheral neuropathies, particularly in their diseases called Niemann-Pick and or globoid cell leukodystrophy. So peripheral neuropathies are possible. Again, these will be young animals. There'll be more than one in the litter affected. Retinal degeneration can be seen with some of these, so it's worthwhile doing a retinal exam. And some will even have other ocular pathologies like cataracts and corneal opacifications. Skeletal and connective tissue pathology is a possibility in some diseases. Mucopolysaccharidosis is one of those, and so you can see structural changes to the skull and the vertebral column, leading to sometimes obvious physical abnormalities in these affected animals. These are some videos of patients that are affected. This is a 7-month-old Shiba Inu presented with GM1, a variety of the lysosomal storage disease, had a profound cerebellar abnormality. We can see the ataxia, quite a springy ataxia in accompaniment with hypermetria. So classic kind of cerebellar ataxia present in this dog. A more mild variant of this at a young adult age is this Japanese Spaniel. We can see here that there is a slight hypermetria to the gait, slight stiffness to the gait, but in no way as severe as that dog you've just seen. So sometimes you can be presented with fairly subtle signs, just a mild ataxia, mild hypermetria, and you have to think about other diseases that affect the cerebellum at this age. So infectious diseases, for instance, would be high on that list. In cats, again, we may see cerebellum affected, and this is a cat that's actually a young adult and had progressive signs to this point where you've got generalized tremors, hypermetria, and ataxia. So can be quite severe, as you can see here. Other causes, again, of cerebellar disease must be considered, but this cat ultimately had what's called neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis. Difficult to look at this and say that this for sure is a storage disease, so these signs are non-specific. They just determine your lesion localization. And this is a border collie that was affected by the same disease, and in this breed of dog, it actually attacks the forebrain first. And so this is a dog that presented with chronic progressive behavioral changes and what appeared to be seizure activity, self-directed frustrations and anger that can be seen in this dog. And so these may be visual abnormalities that the dog is suffering from. This might be type of partial focal seizure activity. Wasn't really directed at aggression towards the owner or to anyone around. It was more to itself or to inanimate objects. And so this type of activity tells us we've got forebrain disease, and certainly need to consider all causes of forebrain disease when we see a patient like this. But then again, worthwhile looking in a book or on the internet to see whether this is a breed that has forebrain disease due to any genetic abnormalities, which in this case was the neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis. So the diagnosis, as we said, antemortem is very difficult, unfortunately. We might get lucky by getting a blood smear where we see vacuoles in the white blood cells, and we could do lymphoid liver tissue smears and see the same sort of thing. Potentially, you can, if you do a CSF, can see vacuolations again in white blood cells. You won't see any changes on radiographs unless you have structural abnormalities because of a specific disease, such as mucopolysaccharidosis. Most of the time, blood work, besides the smears, are completely normal. Other abnormalities that you might pick up in the nervous system may be seen on MRI. So they're kind of non-specific. It's often because you've got a degeneration of tissue, and so you start to see the increased T2 signal in the white matter, which is fairly diffuse and symmetrical, resulting in an increased gray-white matter ratio. So maybe a smaller size, maybe an atrophy of the nervous tissue, and an abnormal ratio of white and gray matter. Confirmation of diagnosis is really by trying to be more specific about the enzyme that is missing or deficient. If you can get less than 5% present, then you've confirmed you have a homozygote, but potentially less than 50% present in carriers or heterozygotes. You do require an age match control, and more than anything, you require a lab that does this. University of Bristol in the UK is a good starting point. University of Pennsylvania is a good starting point for US-based patients. So two places there that can start to help out if you send them whole blood or even tissue or urine, they potentially can work on it. Worthwhile speaking to them in advance about the type and quantities of samples that they would need. There are some molecular genetic tests available for some of these diseases, like fucosidosis, globoid cell leukodystrophy, mucopolysaccharidosis. So, with a suspicion, then you can do these tests, but it's very difficult to actually have that suspicion in many of these cases. Treatment options are minimal. Most of these diseases are universally progressive and therefore fatal, and their patients will end up being euthanized on quality of life bases. Bone marrow transplant is being investigated to try to replace the deficient enzyme, as gene therapy is also is being investigated. Supportive care is necessary in these patients. That may be seizure medications. It may be trying to stop them heart self-harming. Maybe helping them walk and using physiotherapy. But progression, unfortunately, is inevitable. And then just finish off here with other cerebellar diseases of the young that we should consider. Besides those degenerative diseases, then we may have malformations, so cystic accumulations, and we may have viral infections as well. And so some of these should be considerations in younger patients in addition to the degenerative diseases we just mentioned. One of the biggest ones that is worth mentioning is cerebellar hypoplasia. And this is due to in utero infection with panleukopenia. So here we have a cat that presented to us with that disease, and we can see a slightly wide base stance. And as we feed this cat, you'll see an intention tremor as a classic sign of cerebellar disease. And so with this disease, we have cerebellar signs that include ataxia, usually good strength, but hypermetric gait. The base wide stance, and then this obvious intention tremor. So when the camera steadies itself, in this case, you'll see that the cat has a fairly pronounced head bob here. And that head bob is something which we can be fairly certain of as being due to cerebellar disease. Not specific for cerebellar hyperplasia, but you should start thinking about that. I'm not sure if that's the end of our presentation because yeah, I think that is. I thought I had an end slide. Sorry, I don't have that. So that's the end. Thank you very much for your attention. Happy to take any questions. I do see a couple here. So I'm going to try and get those answered if I can read this. Okay. Do you, in hydrocephalus, In trying to make hydrocephalus stable, do you use omeprazole? Yeah, we do. Omeprazole is a proton pump inhibitor, and although we don't know really the precise mechanism of action, it does seem to reduce the CSF production on its own. It may not be strong enough, so we combine it with diuretics and anti-inflammatory steroids. It seems that the other newer generation proton pump inhibitors don't work in the same way, so we'd have to rely on omeprazole on its own, but it is something that might well be successful, yes. Other questions. What is the success rate of hydrocephalus surgery using the ventricular shunt? That's a good question. Perhaps about 70% of dogs can do quite well long term, but there are many complications with putting a foreign body, essentially a shunt, inside the brain and connecting it to the abdomen. So infection, trauma to the nervous system, breakage, blockage are things which prevent this from being a uniformly successful surgery. What is the minimal age that you would perform surgery in an AA subluxation? Again, a good question. The bone can be very soft in a young patient. So if I have a 2, 3 month old dog presenting with AA subluxation, I would often suggest waiting, keeping that dog rested and maybe bandaged until it got to about 5 months. At 5 months, the bone's still somewhat soft, but is more capable of holding implants. So that's the way I would go with this. Right, thank you for your attention. Happy to take any more if they come through. Otherwise, I'll sign out and wish you a good rest of your day.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Simon for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.